Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. On June 3rd, an oil train derailed in the Columbia Gorge town of Mosier, 70 miles east of Portland. It could have been much worse. The typical gorge wind could have been blowing, but amazingly, the air was still that afternoon. If there had been wind, there would have been no more Mosier. Still, the derailment and 14-hour fire that erupted from four ruptured oil tankers sent a toxic black cloud into the air over the town, leaked oil into the Columbia River, and forced the evacuation of the Mosier Community School and 100 residents who live adjacent to the tracks. While it could have been much worse, this derailment realized the fears of many people throughout the Northwest who are trying to stop oil trains from running through the communities. This morning, we're going to talk with Bonnie McKinley, who was arrested sitting on the tracks in Vancouver where the oil trains pass every day a couple weeks ago, and hopefully Arlene Burns, who's the mayor of Mosier, who we're waiting to hear from. Well, Bonnie, welcome to Locus Focus.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So let's talk a little bit about what happened on June 3rd. I mean, I've talked to a lot of people about this, and I kind of want to know your personal story about how you heard about it and what your reaction was.
I was looking at the email and I saw it, and then we started telling everybody about it. And as the day progressed, we realized that a public response was going to be happening in Hood River the very next day on Saturday. And all the plans for that were pretty firmed up 10 p.m. on the same day. So it was quite an alarming feeling for all of us and great concern for the people of Mosier. We were glad when the fire was contained. We were glad that there were no immediate injuries, although we are concerned about long-lasting effects, you know, from the particulates in the air and the trauma that was caused by the people there and will continue. It's a very frightening experience for people.
Well, I had this strange kind of disconnect when I heard the news. And I heard about it, believe it or not, on Facebook. Which is not my favorite way to get information, but I got tagged in a posting that a friend of mine had done that was just a posting from Channel 2 News about it. So as I'm reading that there's this oil train that derailed in the gorge, and then I see that is at Mosier, which I have a particularly fond feeling for, there was this weird disconnect between like this thing that happens all over the country where oil trains are derailing and exploding, and it's almost familiar. But then to have it in a place that's so familiar, and it took me a moment to kind of realize, okay, it's hit home. And I'm wondering if that was your feeling too, of like this thing that you've been worrying about in the abstract, what it felt like when it was suddenly in your own neighborhood.
Exactly, right on the Columbia River. It did take me maybe 30 seconds to really realize this wasn't in another state in Middle America, that here it was, right on our Columbia River, in this beautiful town that we go through to go see wildflowers at McCall State Park.
Right, exactly. Yeah. That's my relationship to it, too. Though also, it's a place where I sometimes have stopped, a great place to buy cherries.
And also, Mosier is famous for me for having a long-lived and viable Occupy in that small town.
And actually, speaking of Mosier, we have the mayor of Mosier with us now, Arlene Burns. Arlene, welcome to Locus Focus.
Thank you.
Yes. We're just praising your town right now. I'm here with Bonnie McKinley, who is a longtime climate activist and other activist. So I don't know if you guys, Bonnie mentioned that she bumped into you, I think.
Literally.
Yeah. So I'm not sure if you remember Bonnie. But we were just talking about what the strange and pretty awful disconnect of hearing the word that the oil train had derailed and exploded in Mosier, and having this horrendous event that had seemed inevitable and yet also an abstraction because it always happens someplace else to happen in our own region. I want to hear from you how it felt to find out that it happened in your own town.
Well, as you say, it was surreal. I was actually out of town at the time, so I got a call probably a minute after it happened from a friend who was just crossing over the bridge when the trains derailed, and he was then reporting to me what was going on, and he just kept saying, "This is really bad. It's really bad." And then I started getting calls from parents wondering where their children were, and I'd already heard that the school was being evacuated. So it was really important that the parents weren't going to the school, but they were going away from the area of danger where the kids had been taken to the Dalles. And then, it's just the next call for me was, all right, we're a sheriff came by. What do you want from your house? We're evacuating. We're probably going to evacuate the town. They were at a level 2 evacuation at that point, and they never did evacuate the whole rest of the town. But basically, my next question to me was, what do you want? So it was my cats, my passport, and my computer hard drive, and the rest of everything I had and owned, I was basically letting go of. And so it's a surreal state. I felt pretty helpless from afar, but at the same time, thank goodness, you know, just due to being able to speak to people on the phone, I was completely engaged in what was going on, even though I was 2,500 miles away.
Well, a lot in the aftermath of Moshe, there was a lot of talk about how we missed the bullet. It was a wake-up call, but nothing really horrible happened. I wonder how much you feel like you missed the bullet and if how accurate it would be to say that nothing really horrible happened.
I think that is absolutely true that we missed the bullet. Just a few factors, and in fact, we have a few of us are putting together the what ifs, and of course, you know, we all say what ifs in all our lives. But if it had been 50 feet further down the track, then all of the oil would have gone into the Columbia River, or into this salmon habitat in Rock Creek, which is its own species of salmon. If it had been a day like the last 10 days here, where we have 20 to 30 mile an hour winds with gusts to 40 miles an hour, our town would have been obliterated. There's no way that the firefighters could have saved the town. There are just so many factors that were in our favor. And then the other one that's quite remarkable and strange, one of the first cars to derail just augered into the earth and pulled out a pothole and threw it onto the road. And 10,000 gallons of that crude oil went into our sewage treatment plant, which killed the plant, but it was the ultimate place to catch 10,000 gallons of crude that otherwise would have gone onto the soil or into the river. So even that was incredibly lucky. But yes, it was still a devastating event, and it's wild to see even the roadside along on the north side of Highway 30, I mean the south side of Highway 30, used to be covered with these thick green mosses that were probably hundreds of years old, and they're all gone, burned off to the core rock, and it's, you know, we still see residuals from what happened, but we've gotten back to normal as far as the town, and people are windsurfing again at the windsurf site, but all of us have this strange, eerie feeling every time a train goes by, and especially if they're the crude oil trains that we know what's possible. We know what happened, and we know how lucky we were that that we still have a town.
Well, actually, this is a question I'm going to pose to both you and to Bonnie McKinley, who's here with me. Shortly after you had a town meeting, this is still within the first week of after the fire. As right after the meeting broke up, I recall some trains went down the track, even though the track hadn't really not been definitely secured as far as being safe again. And that really sent a lot of fear through the communities. I wanted to talk a little bit about your response to that and what was the response of some of our elected officials after your town's response to these trains going through so quickly?
Well, to go back a little bit on the history, we heard rumor that they might start up. We called an emergency city council meeting because the town was horrified that this could actually be the case. And so we passed a resolution asking that no train traffic started until the mess was cleaned up and until it was determined the cause of the crash in the first place. And so then the town meeting was after that. And again, I was out of town at this point still, but involved in this emergency meeting by cell phone. Basically, the meeting ended at 8:15. And without them actually mentioning in the meeting that the trains were going to resume, you know, they waited for everybody to leave, and the first trains came through at 8:30. And people were really upset about this. And the incident command, who included this bevy of professionals, had concluded that the rail, the trains were safe to go, and that included our fire chief and the Union Pacific folks and the DEQ and whomever else was involved in this. We found out later, of course, that ODOT's track inspectors said, how can you possibly think it's safe? All these bolts were rusty and not detected by anything. But the track probably right there in Mosier was some of the safest track on the UP line at that point because it was all brand new. But what was really eerie for all of us was right beside the track, 5 feet away, these tank cars were still there. Some of them were all burned out. Some had oil still in them that had not yet been pumped out. And for me, what just seemed surreal is, yes, the show must go on, and the economy and commerce are important things, but one more day, it took them 2 days to get the rest of the debris away, and that was stopping every single time an active train came through. And believe me, there were a lot of trains that started coming through because there was backup. So it really felt like an affront, and still the people in incident command believed in all their hearts it was a safe scenario for trains to be going, but that was a turning point with the community not really feeling like the best interests of the community were truly in mind.
Well, Bonnie, when you heard that the trains were going through, and there was also a bit of disconnect between whether first they were just going to send trains through, but the railroad agreed not to send all unit oil trains through, which meant they could still send mixed cargo trains through. What was your response, and what connection did that have to do with what you did a couple weeks later? Or actually, I guess it was a following week.
There's great connection and great horror that trains were going through. I'll talk a little bit later about the response that happens in Lac Mégantic to rail going through it all after their disaster. But it was just horrifying because on the day that the derailment happened in Mosier, they were using cars that were the new generation of rail cars. They weren't DOT 111s. There had been a recent inspection, and the train was actually traveling at a slower speed. So, you know, with all those things in place and to still have the accident and to have trains beginning to go through really set an alarm among people in the climate community.
So what did you do?
Well, we started meeting and we started talking fast about a response, and we set up a very immediate meeting to respond to it. And on June 13th, we established a group that later became known as the Fossil Fuel Resistance Network. And we set up outreach teams and media teams and especially outreach to the tribal community and to the people of Mosier. And there were a number of visits out to Mosier to see what kind of response the people there would think would be appropriate. We really wanted to honor the wishes of the tribes and the people of Mosier.
Well, actually, the people of Mosier seem to have been making their way west to Vancouver and Portland a bit since then. A contingent came from Mosier to Vancouver to...
We did, and I think three of us testified at the Port of Vancouver meeting, and a bunch of other people not from Mosier also testified. And, you know, again, it was insane. It's the timing of this is all... There must be some perfection, and maybe that's the optimist in us coming out. But if we can't have this event wake us up to what would happen if this Vancouver terminal came through, and instead of having four oil trains a month, which is already four too many, we would have four to five a day coming through here. And it's to turn this Columbia Gorge, this national scenic area, this treasured place into a fossil fuel superhighway is really unfathomable, especially when you understand in living here the dynamic nature of the climate. We have, in the rainy season, we have landslides and rock falls that often close the freeway. We have tree falls that close the freeway. In the summer, we have these extraordinary winds and dry climate that will make a fire just out of control in a very short period of time. And then the big elephant in the room that I still think no one is addressing properly is how in our right minds could we be allowing these trains to come through when we're all supposedly preparing for one of the great seismic events, a 9 earthquake that will be this Cascadia subduction zone event. That ODOT is trying to get the bridges more secure. You know, there's a big state plan. It's not some conspiracy theory. So it just seems like this perfect storm of derailed trains going high speed that will derail and explode if there's seismic activity, no matter how good the tracks are at the time. And then these storage facilities that will explode. And so what turns into a seismic event that will already be devastating will turn into an inferno that will be just a nightmare in all realms. And this part I still think is people aren't really addressing or focusing on in a way that is like, come on, we have a choice in this. We cannot let this be our future and then go, oh, wow, well, how did that happen? You know, it's predictable, just like this train derailment was predictable.
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning about the derailment of oil train in the city of, in the town of Mosier a few weeks ago. And kind of the aftermath, the lessons learned. And I'm talking with Arlene Burns, who's the mayor of Mosier. And in the studio, we have Bonnie McKinley, who's a very active climate activist here in the Northwest. Well, while you were, or just shortly after you all were testifying at the Port Commission that week, there was also a press conference happening in City Hall in Portland. And your fire chief actually appeared there. And while I was at the press conference, Dan Sears, who's with Columbia Riverkeeper, was very excited because he was getting texts about what was going on and at the Port Commission meeting. And he said, I guess your contingent had just finished testifying. And he was telling me, this is it. They're going to vote down the terminal. There's just, how can they continue to keep the terminal going, the proposal going, when it's so obvious that the implicit dangers. And Eric Brandt, who is the only member of the Port Commission of Vancouver who is against the oil terminal, he had just made a motion to pull the plug on the terminal, and it never got a second. So by the end of the press conference, we were all kind of deflated, realizing that even your testimony didn't change the direction of the port. What was your sense when you heard that the Port Commission was just going ahead with the terminal after all the very heartfelt testimony that you guys had given?
Well, I think, one, I was really glad that he made that proposal, and it took courage on his part, and I think it was also conviction on his part that he really needed to stand up. One of the commissioners is obviously pro-terminal, and the other is still on the fence, and he just probably didn't feel that he had the courage or conviction to stand up in being in that middle person that whole vote was weighing on him. So I'm still hoping that this second commissioner will be influenced appropriately. And also, you know, somebody mentioned at that meeting, the whole city of Vancouver is opposed to this. They might end up putting a recall against the other commissioners if they don't feel like they're really voicing the will of the people. It's really not fair for these elected officials to be actually voting against the will of the people. So there might be consequences down the line, and it might just be that was not the meeting for that to happen, even though we all wished it would have.
Bonnie, I want to pull you into this conversation again. You talked about how quickly the rally in Hood River was pulled together, but let's talk about the action on the tracks in Vancouver that happened 2 weeks after the derailment.
I really would like to address that, but I did want to completely agree with Arlene about the elephant in the room with the seismic impacts. But for me, there's even a larger elephant relative, and that's a woolly mammoth in the room, and that's global climate change. And I think that's the main focus. I mean, it's not the only, of course, we're extremely concerned about the rail safety. We're really concerned about the earthquake concerns. But if we're looking at the entire planet, we're wondering why this rush to produce the largest terminal in North America proposed for Vancouver. And there it is. And in the face of the majority of science saying how absurd it is to continue on this path when we have actual viable alternatives. So for so many people who got arrested, it was, I believe, and for me, completely, concern about climate change and concern about the people impacted by oil by rail. So we were able to pull people together, and pulling people together for an action, an arrestable action, is a big deal. It can take a number of months. You want to have many things in place. You want to have the potential arrestees, the people who are going to risk arrest, well-trained in civil disobedience, and have them have a good understanding of know your rights, of the possible consequences. And a big thing is the definite uncertainty what will happen in a fossil fuel resistance, civil disobedient event. And fortunately, we had help from Eugene's Civil Liberties Defense Center, which has an 11-year history of helping political activists, particularly in environmental and animal rights issues, giving us legal support. And they came to Portland a few times to give training in Know Your Rights and in legal observing, because we had a number of legal observers on site when we hit the tracks on June 18th in Vancouver near the Amtrak station.
Now, I found it a kind of interesting experience because it was really, it seemed very choreographed, both on the part of the protesters and the part of the Vancouver police and also the Union Pacific security people. And there was this dance that was going on.
I don't think it was Union Pacific, actually.
Right, okay.
BNSF.
Oh, okay, right. That's
Burlington,
right.
Northern Santa Fe.
That's Union Pacific's on the Oregon side.
Exactly.
Thanks for the correction. So they first, everybody gets on the tracks, and everybody was everybody, but there were only going to be a certain percentage of those people who stayed on the tracks. And the police knew that. So then they started this whole series of warnings, and the warnings seemed to be very scripted, and everybody that had, particularly people who'd been at the Break Free demonstrations in Anacortes a couple weeks earlier, and other people who've done civil disobedience on the tracks, seemed to have already developed this relationship with the Vancouver police. And what really got me in terms of the theater of it, and this was on the part of the railroad, when it was really time for the arrests and people who weren't going to be arrested had basically removed themselves from the tracks at that point, this train engine starts coming down the tracks and stops, far, maybe less than 100 feet from the demonstrators, maybe more like 25 feet. It seemed really close. And Bonnie and 20 other people are sitting on those tracks. And I had moments of thinking about that anti-war activist Brian Wilson,
exactly,
who was run over by a train. And it was really terrifying, even though there's part of me that knew it's all theater, they're going to stop the train. But this is like, this is the tension moment where we see how much, you know, it's kind of the gut check for everybody. And I was wondering, Bonnie, how you felt at that moment when they did that, because to me, that even though it was symbolic and they weren't going to run you over, it was definitely a show of force. And I wonder not only how you saw their show of force, but how also you felt about your own show of force in that moment.
Well, I thought the show of force by the train, by the locomotive, by the humans that were operating it, was slightly absurd. I knew that, I mean, we were there with Vancouver City Police, with Clark County Police, with the BNF's Railroad Police, and if they were going to permit this potential tragedy of individuals getting creamed by this engine, you know, it's very unbelievable. I wasn't the least bit worried by it. I thought the setting, the layout of the photograph with 21 people in front of it, in front of the engine, was quite dramatic. I thought it was a really great photo op, personally.
And I also want to thank the media for putting that photo op across all the media in
yeah,
the Northwest.
Yeah, we had great photographers on site. So much of the media we make ourselves if we don't get cooperation from local press, but we had a lot of good press on that day. I wasn't the least bit worried, and I was completely comfortable. I knew a number of the people on the tracks. It was a well-organized action. There were police liaisons on site, and there were jail support ready to act in the event of arrest. A lot of times police officers, I've been in situations where police officers will say, yeah, you're going to be arrested if you do this and this, and then arrests never happen. There seemed to just be terrific camaraderie. Inside the circle, there was song. There was the passing of bread and people linking arms. It was tremendous feeling of solidarity and conviction. A lot of us have been working on opposing the Vancouver oil terminal for 3 years and proud to be part of the climate community and with the people of Vancouver. We really share their concern.
Well, as an audio recorder, because I was recording the whole thing that day, it was probably the most dramatic recording I've ever made, because there was the train whistle, a very powerful blaring whistle, and then there was all this chanting and singing going on. And the train whistle started out going, toot, toot, and then people were chanting with a more of a rhythmic feel to it. So then it was like, toot, toot, and the train whistle going, toot, toot, and they were doing this thing back and forth. And I found it very interesting that the engineer who was in charge of the whistle of the train was actually riffing off of the demonstrators. So again, that gave me the sense of theater. But then on the other side, as I was leaving and I was walking back with some people, and we were talking to the Vancouver police and thanking them for being very polite and respectful, and we watched how they videotaped every single action that they did. So they were really trying to follow the law. So we commented to them, and they said, well, this isn't Chicago. We were happy to hear that. But then I heard how long it took for people to get out of jail. And a friend of mine who was doing jail support was suggesting that maybe the Vancouver police were a bit passive aggressive. And I wonder if that was your experience.
I think the amount of time that we were held was not extreme. That's just my personal thought. And that part of that is because I was released earlier, because I told them I get migraines, and I was asking if I could keep my sunglasses, and they thought it was a physical condition. So they did honor that. But I mean, when I've been arrested before for climate issues, I've spent the weekend or overnight. So to be released the same day, I was grateful for personally. I can't speak for the others.
Some people didn't get out till much later that evening.
About around 8 or 9 p.m. exactly. Yeah.
So I guess I thought for a small number of people being arrested in a small town, it seemed like it should have gone faster. So why do you think, and I guess my friend was telling me that they were, when they questioned why people were being held so long, why it was taking so long to process everybody, they kept referring to the disruption, because of the disruption. So it seemed that there was something, there were things that were not being expressed directly that maybe would have made some people more comfortable if they'd known how the police actually felt about them.
I can't address that this time, because we need to speak with our lawyers. The whole Vancouver 21 team doesn't have our media plan in place yet.
Okay, we won't ask you any.
Sorry.
That's okay. Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with Bonnie McKinley, who was arrested on the tracks in Vancouver. Now it's about 3 weeks ago, I think. Something like that.
Yeah.
June 18th, anyway. And we'll get to why she wanted to do this in just a moment. We're also speaking with Arlene Burns, who's the mayor of Mosier, the little town in the gorge that was almost blown up by a oil train on June 3rd. Arlene, you mentioned your fire chief a little while back, who went along with the plan to start moving the trains again through Mosier. However, he seems to be one of the most transformational stories that's come out of this whole incident. I heard him saying right after the fire, and while the train was still lying in pieces on the side of the track, that it was insane to take oil trains through the gorge. Then you told me when we talked a week later that he had signed off on the plan for the oil trains to continue to go through. Then I saw him the day that you were testifying at the Vancouver Port Commission. He was at the Portland City Council press conference talking about how we had to stop all the oil trains, and he was again talking about how it was an insanity. He was for stopping all the oil trains going through the gorge. And then the following Saturday at the rally before people sat in on the tracks in Vancouver, he was actually calling for keeping the fossil fuels in the ground, and we have to move into a whole era of renewable energy. So how do you speak to his transformation?
Well, I think he was in a tough position, or in a good position, both, but he was part of the incident command of these very talented, skilled people coming in to deal with the aftermath of the incident, and he probably trusted their judgment, it would have been difficult for him perhaps at that time. You know, we've talked about it several times because he was upset with the town for going against the incident command because he felt assured that it was safe. And so I don't know. I guess maybe it would be just the confusion of the event itself and also the confusion of his roles. And also the thing of on the local level and on the larger level, you know, how can you say that it's safe for trains when you're saying that oil trains aren't safe and they aren't discerning between what kind of trains they're even taking? So, yeah, it was, I think it's been a very stressful situation for him. And I do think one thing for sure is before this incident, he wasn't as opposed to the oil trains as he is now. And I think he's realized how helpless we are, even with the great support of the mutual aid partners coming in on a community level and then from Portland and all the help that came in to help us deal with this. Really, these communities, wherever these tracks are and these fires start, we don't have the equipment, we don't have the expertise, and we don't have the resources to deal with these things. And again, just one factor, like something like a little wind, which we're famous for, would have been the difference of a very different outcome. So I think he's seen the light in that sense, and yet at the same time he was probably influenced by this group of experts that he was part of the inner circle of.
Well, actually, I was really impressed by the speech that he gave in downtown Vancouver a couple weeks ago, where, yeah. And he was really making the connection. He was talking about the woolly mammoth in the room that Bonnie referenced a little bit earlier, that this is about keeping fossil fuel in the ground, that there's no reason to pull it out. He was even referencing the connections between this what he was deeming a very unnecessary oil terminal and very unnecessary oil trains and dangerous oil trains and the larger danger that they portend, which is the danger of runaway climate change. So
right.
I'm wondering if in your community people are starting to see beyond just the fear of your town burning up and also understanding that there's a really big picture issue of why fossil fuels are part of the past or should be part of the past and why we need to move to a renewable future.
Oh, absolutely. We are all in support of exactly that and aware of it for a long time. And I've been involved with environmental film festivals for the last, well, since the mid-90s. So it's been an issue for me that has been it's kind of insane that we've known this for a long time. I really think the turning point for probably a different planet was when Jimmy Carter was president. And he saw it, and back at that point, had we taken his tack, it would have been a different planet now than it is. And so I think it's been something looming a long time, and people have their heads in the sand, and it's insane that we call ourselves intelligent species when at the same time we're fouling our nest. I also ran a film festival in Monterey, California, that was based on ocean issues called the Blue Ocean Film Festival. And the acidification in the ocean is another byproduct of this carbon emission. And again, people have no idea. Every other breath we take is from the plankton that we are killing from the carbon falling in the sea and acidifying all these little calcium-based creatures in their larval forms to where, you know, it's so short-sighted, and it's a runaway train is probably the best way to put it, and we need a paradigm shift for sure, and yet here we are, we're all driving cars. There are solutions that are, and there might be some sacrifice, but really, if we just, as a leader of the free world, could make the shift of being a leader in this capacity, then we might at least have a chance to adapt to a better world. I don't think we can even stop climate change at this point because the world is not something that you can take fossil fuels out of. But I absolutely agree that it's incredibly short-sighted, especially in lieu of what we know and what's happening on the two poles with the oceans melting. And people don't understand the consequences of that when you have this influx of fresh water into the Gulf Stream, and all of a sudden the flow of the Gulf Stream is changing. The jet streams are changing. It's not something to mess with, and we've messed with it to such an extent. So, yes, I utterly believe we need to, especially this is based on the greed and power of a very few. It has nothing to do with the common good, not only in Mosier or in Oregon, but on a planetary level.
Well, Bonnie, I want to talk some more about, or actually begin to talk about some of the plans about protests that are coming up, and protests, rallies, educational events. We're entering into a very special set of days. Is that correct?
Yes.
There'll be a lot of actions around the region about fossil fuels and about particularly about oil trains.
Exactly.
And why this week?
Why this week? July 6th is the third anniversary of the Lac Mégantic oil train derailment in Quebec, Canada. And for the last 3 years in Portland, we have commemorated it, but it's now part of a Canadian and U.S. observation of Stop Oil Trains Week of Action. So there's events all over the region, and there are some nearby. Very nearby.
What's happening here in Portland?
On July 6th, which is the third anniversary, we're having a commemoration of the 47 lives that were lost at Lac Mégantic in the serious, horrific train derailment there. And you know, so much of the discussion of these lives has been on the fiery demise, the very last moment of their lives. And so this year, we wanted to think more about their lives as they live them, as much as we, who never met them, could connect. So local people concerned about climate and concerned about oil by rail in our region composed 47 spoken word and visual art and expressions for these people. I can read one example for you. This is about Jimmy Paulin. No trace. No trace has been found of you, Jimmy. Assumed dead. Still, I hope you're not. I hope that you fled that awful scene and continue your quiet life in peace, breathing in and out the sweet breezes of life. We really want to focus on the life that we want to preserve on our very special planet. And we do this in all sorts of ways. So on July 6th, starting at 11 o'clock, running till 2, we'll have continuous shows of our 50-minute program right in Pioneer Square in the small amphitheater. And I really hope people from the community will come. It will be somewhat upbeat. We'll have tables from a lot of the different climate and environmental focused organizations in the region, so people can learn more about how they can become engaged. So it'll be music and it'll be spoken word and hopefully a lot of sharing. There's been a beautiful painted backdrop of the Music Cafe that was the night spot where a number of the victims were lost, but we want to focus on the life that these people lived and the happiness and the music that they experienced.
I guess also in my mind is we can celebrate in a kind of bittersweet way that that didn't happen to Mosier, because that that was the first thought that
yes,
I had when I heard
exactly
about what was going on in Mosier, and I thought of Lac Mégantic and thinking, I mean, Mosier is a much smaller town than Lac Mégantic was, or probably partly still is.
Right, and we had 200 kids in the school, which was
exactly
right by the track. So that was our precious, precious asset. All the children of the community were in the blast zone, so it could have been a really, you know, unfathomable tragedy for us.
Well, we're just about out of time, but Bonnie, is there anything else going on in the next week that people might want to know about?
Well, on July 7th, there is a Just Transition event happening open to the public at 7 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church. And on July 8th, there's a major Quinault Indian Nation-led event, and we encourage people to go out to that. That's in Hoquiam, Washington. They are facing another oil terminal proposal from Westways Industries. So it will involve tribal canoes and kayaktivism and land base, and if people RSVP, they can share in a tribal meal.
Well, I want to thank.
I was going there. We were invited, and I'm actually going down to San Luis Obispo for a rally to fight the Phillips 66 terminal there in the Alberta tar sands. So, the whole community down there is also completely in tune with what's going on here, and you know that Alberta tar sands will come right through here as well. I mean, I think basically the oil companies are looking for places for vulnerable communities all along the whole West Coast, and it's like a Swiss cheese. We plug one up and then they find another. So this is an ongoing task that we really have to stay on top of and work on a federal level to change the laws, to change the safety of these train cars to really where, you know, they deem them unfit for movement, and to nip the bud in all of these terminals that are being proposed up and down the coast.
Well, I think it's very fortunate you have a good mayoral ally in San Luis Obispo. My old friend Jan Marx is the mayor there, and she's been leading the charge against the oil trains.
So, oh, nice.
Well, I hope you meet her. You can talk mayor to mayor about how to stop the oil trains. Well, anyway, I want to thank you both, Arlene and Bonnie, for being here on the 4th of July and sharing your experiences and your future view. And I hope that together we can really have a renewable future that so many of us are talking about.
And an independence from fossil fuels. How about that?
I like that. Independence Day from fossil fuels. Okay, so thanks a whole bunch.
All right.
We've been talking with Arlene Burns, who's mayor of Mosier, and climate activist Bonnie McKinley, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locusfocus. Next week, we'll be talking with Robert Justice about the affordable housing crisis in Portland. My engineer is Natasha Delafin. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to be broadcasting the Blues Festival starting in about an hour. So we'll see you there. I'll be down there myself. Thanks for listening.